Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
And welcome to Thursday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand in the Allstate Skyline Studio on the Wintrust Business Lunch. You heard the voices there. We will talk to Bill Geiger a little bit about his retirement and your retirement, too. Also, Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business will be along to talk about real estate. But we'd like to start on Thursdays with a visit from CNET. And on a phone this afternoon is Rochelle Garner, who is the features editor at the CNET and news editor as well. Rochelle, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
My pleasure to always be here. Thank you.
You know, I drove today, but if I hadn't driven, I would have taken a Lyft. Well, no, if I hadn't driven, I would have taken an Uber. No, I would have taken a Metro train. But Lyft is beating, what, Uber when it comes to going for an IPO. Lyft has took some steps today to go public. Tell me about that, and tell me why it's significant when it comes to this fight over ride sharing.
Absolutely. Well, Lyft announced that it had filed confidentially, that it's going to go IPO. By confidentially, normally when a company files, we can then read that securities filing and really get to know everything about that company. Right now, we can't because it's still basically locked behind confidential doors. But what's interesting about the timing is that they're beating out Uber. And that's interesting because how much appetite does an investor have to invest in more than one of these ride-hailing
right.
companies? The thought being that if Lyft comes out first, many investors will think that's enough. And really, we're talking about investors that are the institutional investors, not just mom-and-pop investors like you and me, but people who are putting lots of money into these things. So the idea is that by beating out Uber, they may be getting much more, obviously, marketing buzz and potentially more of the public money that's out there that would otherwise go to Uber.
And they need to go first, right? Because Lyft is the underdog in this fight.
It really is, absolutely. And it's also, the valuations is a sort of black box, how much is a company actually worth. But the analysts are saying that Lyft is worth maybe about $15 billion when it goes public, and at Uber is $120 billion, which is pretty much eye-watering just to even think about.
Now, one of the things I'm reading, too, is that this stock offering and then Uber coming next is going to sort of test investors' willingness to put their money in companies that aren't making money. I didn't realize that Uber wasn't making money. Lyft is not making money either yet?
Again, it's private. We're pretty sure that they are losing money. So the analysts say that Uber, for example, while it may have taken in more than $2 billion in revenue last year, they think that they lost over $1 billion last year. Lyft took in, I believe it had said that it's taken $235 million in a quarter, the third quarter. But analysts think that they also lost a good chunk of change. That's the thing, when you're investing so heavily, as these companies are, it's really, really hard to actually have a positive cash flow, and they're not yet.
And the idea is that with the investment, that eventually that cash flow will come. We're just not at that point yet.
And both are looking into self-driving cars, very expensive, and also other forms of transportation, such as rentable bikes.
All right, I wanted to tell me about your front door. Do you have a video doorbell?
You know, we just got one for Christmas, and so I'm waiting for my husband to install it.
That's the thing. It's the big, hot Christmas gift, isn't it?
It really is. And what's interesting is Ring, which is owned by Google, has created an app called Neighbors. What people have been doing all along anyway is sharing and emailing some of the videos about what's going on in our neighborhood to other neighbors to kind of get a sense of what's happening. Ring saw this. They developed an app called Neighbors, and it's a way for you to share what is on your video anonymously, and it's your choice about when you want to take it down. But it's a way then for Ring, the police, the authorities to kind of get a sense of, it's like a giant CCTV neighborhood watch
right.
is really what we're looking at here.
And so a couple points in. I don't know where you live, but do you feel that for security you need this video, or do you feel like it's sort of the thing and I want to try it out?
You know, it's interesting in both ways. I live in a sleepy community in Northern California, and yet last year, the local police kept saying that robberies were up.
Yeah.
And the only times that they were actually nailing the thieves were when those homes happened to have a camera. So I'm thinking that even if you think, not my neighborhood, I'm just a little suburban neighborhood, why would anybody care? It does seem like it's a way to kind of know what's happening.
Right.
And especially this time of the year where there's a lot of people taking stuff from your doorsteps.
Well, I'm so glad I'm talking to you about this, Rochelle, then, because I am one of those guys. I tend to think that we, by and large, the customers who are buying these don't need them. And that when you start sharing surveillance video in social groups, you're only sort of perpetuating fear. You know, you're feeding on others' fears, and it's only building by watching those. But you bring up some good points, and the cops say that they really are an effective tool.
They really are. So, you know, do I like the idea of more surveillance? Not particularly, but at the same time, it does seem like there's some value to it. So, basically, I haven't answered your question because
no,
well, you go both ways.
Well, you know what you have? You've given me a great perspective because I live in a sleepy suburban neighborhood as well. And actually, we had an incident where the neighbors had video, and that video was used. So, yeah, I'm probably wrong on that. So I'm going to give that to my wife for Christmas. Thanks, Rochelle. You helped me with that. I was either going to give her a Ring doorbell or a video doorbell, or I was going to give her a ride into outer space. Now, do I still have time to get the ride to outer space?
You know, you probably do, except that Ring will cost a lot less because the tickets for Virgin Galactic are, and are you ready for this, $250,000
per
ticket.
But Branson says he's going to bring people into outer space before the end of the year.
Well, but these won't be the tourists.
Okay.
Which is probably a good thing. I wouldn't want to be able to decide that things aren't working quite as smoothly as they are after just handing over $250,000. So this will be professional astronauts. First off, I didn't know there were professional astronauts,
right,
but apparently there are. And what's interesting, if you remember from the Wright stuff and Chuck Yeager's and the X-1, you'd actually go up in a very large plane, and that plane would then drop the next plane down, and it would then shoot off into space. That's how Virgin Galactic is going to be working. It's not like a straight vertical launch that we think of like with SpaceX.
Right.
And it's also not sure. They're not saying, is this a full orbit? Do you kind of sort of skip into space and then come back out again? In which case, that's kind of a really fast way to blow $250,000.
So should I start?
So there's a lot of things that need to be answered.
When should I start saving my money then? When can I put down my $250 and go up there?
Well, you can start saving now. I mean, people have been paying, and prices have been going up since 2014 when they first announced it. So if you want to be able to anticipate before the next price hike, I would do it now.
Rochelle Garner is a feature and news editor at CNET. Rochelle, great to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Bill Geiger is in our studio. Our conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Good to be here, sir.
And I saw you early this morning, and you were telling me you had quite a party last night.
It was our annual client Christmas party. We had about 160 people there.
That never comes up during our chat, so if you're a client of Geiger's, you get to go to a really nice Christmas party, too.
It was nice.
That's a bonus because, you know, I would imagine if you're there long enough, you tend to forget what happened on Wall Street the day before.
Well, we had... No, I can't say that.
No.
I was going to say we had the markets closed just for our party.
That's right. The markets were closed yesterday,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Today they're down, what, now down 495. They were down hundreds more earlier.
Yeah, they were down 750 so far this morning. Yeah.
And, I mean, where are we? Just in this new volatile time? Should we get used to this? Or what do you think?
I think you have to do more than get used to it, Steve. You know, it must sound like a broken record sometimes. We're always talking about people, if you're in your late 50s to early 60s, you really should control your risk. You really should start creating income. Well, this is kind of like a call to action.
You and I have been talking for years, and this is the scenario you've been talking about.
Yeah, and you know, whether or not this is the big one, I don't know, and nobody else knows either. But if you're in your late 50s, you're getting close to retirement, you better treat it as if it is, because if it is, And again, I'm not saying this, but if this is the big downturn, it's going to change the way you retire unless you do something about it.
How much time, I mean, the idea is that if you lose what you've built up now, you're going to have to work a lot longer to build that up, or you're just not going to be able to have as much income to live off of.
You're either going to have to work longer, or you're going to live smaller in retirement. And, you know, your late 50s, you got more money you've ever had in your entire life, Steve. Last thing you want is a big loss at this stage because you don't have 30 years to make it up.
All right, so what do you do? What should we be doing?
Come into our office, and we're going to talk about it.
Because I've got right now it's stuffed under my mattress.
Yeah.
That's probably not the right strategy.
We do this all the time. We meet with folks, we run some tests to help them understand how much risk they have, then we make some recommendations to get their risk level low. They can still get growth, but you want to get the risk down, and you want to begin creating dependable, sustainable income. And Steve, if you have a big loss at this stage, that's that much less assets that you can use to create the income.
I would imagine if you have a loss at this time and you're looking at risk, that's not going to change your where you should be when it comes to risk right now, because that's more about your age than how much money you've got. Does that make sense?
That's correct.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's more about your age.
I mean, so you're not going to go risky to try to make a lot of money late in your savings because you can't afford that.
No, you absolutely don't want to do that. You know, the market's down some right now. The thing you want to use is, think about this as a wake-up call. You know, you've been putting it off, really sitting down and working on a game plan, a map to get you where you need to be. This is the time to begin.
It's funny you say that, because I was thinking of our conversation driving in today with almost those very words, because we talk about it every week,
right?
And I'm sure people listen to it every week, but they don't quite pick up the phone and make the call.
Well, this is the time.
This is probably a pretty good time.
This is the time. Consider this like a wake-up call.
Right.
And Steve, and we say this before, but I'm going to kind of lay this out again. When people call in, and we're going to take the first, you know what, today we're going to take the first 10 callers.
All right, there we go.
It's that serious. The first 10 callers who call in who have at least $500,000 saved up for retirement, we're going to help them put together a full retirement plan, including a retirement income plan. We're going to help them get their arms around how much risk they actually have. And we're going to lay out a retirement income plan for them so they know how they're going to pay their bills.
And that's one of the things we talk about, too. You're not stopping. You're still growing your money. You're just doing it in a different sort of vehicle.
You're just not investing like a 30-year-old.
Bill Geiger, thanks for coming by today. We'll see you again in a week.
Good to see you, sir.
All right. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It's 12:36. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio. He writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business and comes down from time to time when he feels like squeezing us in. So thanks for your presence today, Dennis. We're always better
bless
when
you.
You're here. And Dennis usually comes by with great news when it comes to the housing market. Wait, that's not true.
No.
Dennis usually comes by to tell us just how badly we're doing when it comes to housing in this state.
I bring my dark cloud with me.
And like Pigpen in the Charlie Brown Christmas special.
Exactly.
And so there's the new study out of 100 cities in the U.S. and their forecast for the housing market next year. And we come in dead last?
Dead last for the second time. Yeah, we were 100th in the forecast for 2017, and we were in our 100th in the forecast for 2019. We moved up to 84 last year, the forecast for this year. This has a lot to do with, a lot of it just has to do with the fact that while we are recovering, others are
recovering faster.
Well, they're recovered and moving ahead. We have job growth, but it's not as fast as other places. We have home value growth, but it's not as fast as other places. And so this forecast from Realtor.com, which is a pretty credible forecast, and you saw the story. I went back and looked at how they did with their forecast for 2017 compared it to our market and how they're doing so far this year. They tend to be pretty accurate. And what they're forecasting for Chicago is the weakest of 100 markets.
So
sales
not
down
only,
and prices
right,
down.
So not only the number of sales will drop, then the prices will drop.
Yeah.
That's a double whammy. And of the 100, there are only three or four cities that were have both indices
that
dropping?
Have both going negative. Yeah, and let's just be careful about the word drop. They have sales coming down about 7%. They only have prices coming down, I think it's 1.5%,
right,
which wouldn't really be a drop. It's more sort of a slight decline or flatness.
Even the author of the report sort of told you that she didn't find the numbers too troublesome.
No, that one of the reasons prices will come down is that we're still in a low inventory situation. A lot of other cities, that has improved. That's been going on all over the country for a couple of years. We still have tight inventory, and so a lot of people don't buy, just can't find what they want, so prices don't.
Okay, that explains it for me, because I've had a lot of simple questions this week.
Yeah.
And that's one of them. I'm thinking, wait a minute, if we have a low inventory, I would think that would drive prices up. But what you're saying is that because there are so few homes to choose from, people are just not buying?
Yeah, you know, one of the problems we've had for a while is that a lot of the inventory is sitting still. Something good that comes on the market, something fresh, refreshed, decorated to today, or finished to today's standards, those tend to go quickly at almost any price range in almost any part of the map. But there are a lot of properties where either you couldn't afford to or you simply decided not to bring it up to date. And those, or they have problems, or it's the biggest house in the neighborhood and things like that. And those have tended to just sit and sit and sit. So one of the problems we have is that a lot of the inventory on the market is, I don't want to say unsellable, but very difficult to sell.
And is that in the South Side Lakefront area, the South Suburbs? Is that what, I know you just put up a story about the South Lakefront area.
I don't know that that would necessarily be what, it figures into the south part of the city. What I found out today, what I reported today, is that Hyde Park Township, which is larger than Hyde Park neighborhood, it essentially runs from Grand Boulevard all the way down to the Indiana line, is the only township of all the townships in the city and suburban Cook County where home values, the estimate of home values by the Cook County assessor are down in the past 3 years. It's a three-year cycle. You know this. They
right.
do one half of Cook, the other half of Cook, and then the city.
And you know which part of the city by the outcry.
And exactly,
yeah.
Right. And so earlier this year, I was reporting on these enormous increases in areas around Logan Square and Lincoln Park and Lakeview. People are upset there because you're estimating my home value has gone up so much that obviously my tax bill will go up as a result. In the south part of the city, in parts of Hyde Park Township, where values are down in the double digits in 2018, 14-18%, not all of Hyde Park Township, the average overall is much smaller than that. That does mean that their property tax bills won't be affected, but it also means their household wealth isn't going up, their ability to sell isn't going up, and the neighborhood tends to sort of linger or
is
languish.
Is it a jobs issue? I mean, what's going on there?
I think that's part of it. That's something we've talked about. In fact, I just talked about a few minutes ago, but you and I have many times, is this lack of employment is really a fast-moving employment base. It creates a fast-moving real estate base, and there's been higher black unemployment in this city than general unemployment. There's the problem with Southeast Side neighborhoods. One person told me who's lived there his entire life is they're still trying to recover from the loss of steel
right,
in the 1970s.
Right.
Those were steel worker neighborhoods. And this, he said, is one of the reasons they're still in decline, is that there hasn't been a replacement of that employment base.
And you referred to it a little bit just a few minutes ago, but there also then was a study from the Brookings Institute
yeah.
about the difference in segregated neighborhoods and how that hurts when it comes to equity for African-American homeowners.
You know, it's a really interesting study. I will say I was surprised that we didn't rank higher on the list. That
of segregated cities?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they did a very careful study. It's not, comparable homes, three bedroom, two bath here in a majority black and a majority non-black neighborhood, that sort of thing. But they also looked at school quality and restaurant frequency and all those sorts of things, tried to really get comparable homes, and found that essentially, on average, homeowners in majority black communities in Chicago are missing about $38,000 in home value. overall, across America, it's about $15 billion that people who live in majority black neighborhoods are missing from their home equity. And that, again, makes it, it has an impact on your household wealth. It makes it more difficult for you to sell. It makes it more difficult for you to tap that equity to either repair the house or invest. It's problematic.
It's a stretch, maybe, but, you know, we talk about minority startups and things like that, yeah. And how the first round of funding is often friends and family. Well, this is an example of, because of where the homeowners might live, that friends and family equity that they might invest in their niece's business or nephew's business isn't necessarily there where it would be if they lived in a predominantly white neighborhood.
That's a great point that I hadn't really thought of. I think of home equity as what you use for, like, your children's education or taking care of an elderly parent, those kinds of things. But that too, yeah, I mean, the problem of household wealth for black household, or the problem of the inability to build household wealth for black households, has all kinds of ramifications, right. And that's a really important one I wouldn't have thought of.
Dennis Rodkin writes about real estate for Cranes. We're going to take a break and hit it again in just a couple of minutes. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You know what time it is now, Dennis? It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. So I'd be lying if I said I wasn't always thinking about food. So let's start with some pizza. Maybe Pizza Hut? Yeah, okay. I know it's not the best, but the right place and the right time, so good. Anyway, Pizza Hut is buying the Chicago-based online ordering company Quick Order, who they've been using for years now, but they're finally bringing them under their company umbrella. With a full range of service offerings, the Chicago company has been around for over 20 years, being one of the original Chicago food tech players. Oh, God, that was so good. Time for dessert. How about ice cream? You know the Chicago ice cream shop Bobtail? Well, they're also getting bought out by an Ohio company, Johnson Real Ice Cream. The Chicago shop was born out of a small University of Chicago alumni group and slowly grew into one of the city's go-to ice cream establishments that's open year-round. The buyout does mean that the iconic Bobtail name is going away, but CEO Chris Hill will make sure that the customers' favorite flavors will stick around. I'm so full. Time for a nap. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Hey, Dennis, Black Friday, you know?
Yeah.
I actually ponied up and bought a subscription to Cranes.
Did you really?
After all these years of taking your stuff for free, I took the responsible route, and now I'm a paying customer.
That's great. I'm sure that some of that will end up in my bank book.
As opposed to what I give you every week for coming by here?
Exactly.
You wrote a piece about house flipping, and we've talked about flipping in the past. Mm-hmm. Is that still going on? Is it dying out, or what's going on?
Still going on. It looks to me as if 2017 is very likely to have been the peak. What I said on Twitter is flipping is slipping. Everything is changing. The primary thing is that the numbers are down considerably. First three quarters of the year, about 4,000 homes flipped in the Chicago area. In 2017, there were over 7,000. So unless we have a whole lot to happen flipped in the last 3 months of the year, 2017 will turn out to have been the peak. They're also selling for less and taking longer to sell.
So are they out of homes to flip, or are they just
in part, this is good news. One of the major things that fueled the flipping wave is the huge foreclosure inventory we had. Chicago had the biggest in the nation. We had this enormous overhang, especially in the south and west sides and the south suburbs. And a lot of that has been mopped up by these rehabbers. We've talked about this over time. Tens of thousands of homes flipped in those regions, in those areas, as well as farther out, and there just aren't as many foreclosed homes now.
Okay, now, since we're talking about this, it kind of reminds me of something else we've brought up from time to time. But during the housing crisis, you talked about how there were big real estate companies, I think they were real estate companies,
right,
buying up homes and renting them out with the idea that when things recovered, they would sell them. So where are we with those, and why wouldn't that inventory be on the market?
Well, that inventory would be separate from this flipper.
I understand that.
Those are all fixed.
I've jumped off.
But they, most of those are still
rentals.
Rentals.
Okay.
Yeah. I think a lot of the problem is, well, there are two problems. One, they bought so many, they can't sell them as a lump. There have been a couple of portfolios put on the market and not sold.
Mm-hmm.
There was one 5-6 months ago that was put on the market that didn't move. But the other problem, the other thing is, this comes back to something I mentioned, like a broken record. Our market is not recovering quickly. So the recovery on your investment would not yet probably be where they wanted it
so
to be.
So the money they put into it, they might not be getting out of it.
It's very likely.
Were they buying these group, the several homes, with the idea of selling them as a group or selling them back individually?
Well, a couple of the first, well, yes, both.
Okay.
Generally, the idea was we'll amass this portfolio, and then as time goes by, I did a story, it might be 5 years ago, about one of the big buyers. They said, well, what we don't want to do is, you know, we've bought several hundred homes. We don't want to put them all on the market at once because
that would be,
you know,
a bad
we'd
move.
Be selling against
right,
ourselves,
right,
essentially, and pull prices down. But again, there was this one portfolio, a rehab company had built up, and they wanted to sell it just because they didn't want to be landlords anymore. But for the most part, the idea is sell them in dribs and drabs over the years to prop up.
Of course. I mean, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Why would you want to put 100 of your own homes on the market
exactly,
at the same time?
So you deacquisition them slowly.
All right. So I know that the forecast for home sales next year is sort of bleak in the area. I have an idea.
Take
the home you want to sell and price it at $4
million. That works.
Right? I mean, that would make it a hot commodity.
It is astonishing to me. Just before I came up here, I found there's a new sale today at $6.9 million. So that puts us at 71 sales so far this year at $4 million and up.
Which is a record.
Which is beyond a record.
Way
beyond. The most we've ever seen in a year in the Chicago market, which is not just the city, is 52. That's a couple of years ago. Last year, there were 46 sales at $4 million and up in 12 months. And as of today, in 2018, there are 70.
So is this another haves and have-nots? We go from, you know, the south side where homes are still underwater to the north side and north suburbs where they're selling for $4 million?
Yeah, it's two markets. We've had two recoveries going on for quite a while. A lot of these people are probably, I don't know how they afford them, but people have told me
that's all we do. I've driven. How do they afford that?
Exactly. But a lot of the developers and things have said quite a bit of it is stock wealth from the run-up in the stock market. So obviously that doesn't bode well for next year. And some of it is very strategic planning by a couple of developers building super fabulous places to the tastes.
We're talking about the building on Walton.
Yeah, Walton
and others
have really designed it to be what the $4-6 million buyer will go for.
We've only got 10 or 15 seconds left. So if homes are selling for a lot of money and homes aren't selling in some spots, should we be worried about the 100 ranking if we're selling? Because maybe it just depends on where we are within this market.
Well, I don't know what you mean by should we worry.
If we're ranking 100, that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
But maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we're ranking 100 because of some really bad selling areas. And overall, if we're selling in Buffalo Grove or Wheeling or LaGrange, our market's going to be better than 100.
Yes. Everything is super local in real estate. And some of the figures we've just talked about are regional. And there is a distinction, but a difference between those two. But we should keep in mind that we all rise and fall together. We are one municipality, and if somebody in the region is unemployed and abandoning a home, that does at some point affect mine.
Check it out at chicagobusiness.com. Dennis Rodkin, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.